Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Kennan Institute. My name is Bo Pomeranz. I'm Deputy Director here at the Kennan Institute, and today we're pleased to welcome you to our seminar on public interest law in Russia. This event is co-sponsored by the Henry M. Jackson Foundation, and we are, of course, very pleased to be joined today by the Jackson Foundation's chairman, John Hempelman. This is the sixth conference that the Kennan Institute has organized with the support of the Jackson Foundation, and we are, of course, very grateful and so pleased for all their support and their long record of cooperation. Today we're going to be talking about public interest law in Russia, focusing on both its practice and its overall ramifications in Russia, and also trying to understand better what the current situation is and what it actually means in practice. Russian public interest law finds its roots in Tsarist Russia, where there were numerous civic-minded lawyers who provided free and independent legal advice to promote Russia's development of rule of law and the law-based state. And this tradition was revived in the aftermath of the Soviet Union's collapse, when lawyers once again were given opportunities to challenge legal policies and pronouncements of the Russian state. And we're very fortunate today to have four people here who are representative of that development and who will talk today about how they practice public interest law, what sort of cases they pursue, and finally, what sort of impact that's having on the broader development of Russia as a rule of Russian rule of law, which is, of course, a very difficult subject in light of all our current developments, but nevertheless, it is very important to hear how these things continue to evolve despite political changes. But before I introduce today's panelists, all expert practitioners, I want to turn the floor over to John Hempelman.
Thank you, Will. Good morning, everyone. On behalf of the Henry M. Jackson Foundation, I'm pleased to be here today and welcome you to another one of our very productive collaborations with the Kennan Institute. Will promoted me. I am the president of the board of the Jackson Foundation, and I'm happy to say that our chairman is Helen Jackson, the wife of the late senator, and Helen herself had a great interest in civil society in Russia and was part of a group of wives of United States senators that gathered regularly to do what they could to promote civil society in the former Soviet Union. The Jackson Foundation was founded almost 30 years ago after the untimely death of Senator Henry M. Jackson. And we have a long history of being active in Russian affairs and with a particular interest in the development of civil society and the rule of law. I'm very pleased. I'm a real estate lawyer from Seattle, but involved in civic affairs like my colleagues here at the program this morning. Our interest as a foundation in this stemmed from the senator's great interest in U.S.-Soviet geopolitical affairs. We called him Scoop, as you may remember. Scoop Jackson himself was convinced that the Russian people would benefit most from an engaged citizenry and a government that respects the individual. So today's program that's focusing on using the law to promote the interest of the public stems from directly from the senator's legacy. We have been at the foundation actively engaged in the Russian NGO sector since 1989. And while this is a challenging moment in the history of U.S. Russian affairs, we're convinced that this kind of program is more necessary today than ever before. And this has been quite a month for the Jackson Foundation and the Kennan Institute in our focus on Russia, because just a couple weeks ago we hosted in Seattle, and then Will, you hosted here in Washington, a group of Russian NGO leaders who reported after their time in Seattle meeting with all of our NGO sector leadership and then here that they felt it profoundly changed their view of collaboration among the NGOs in the United States and Russia. And so that is a very, very positive development. We're excited about it. I'm anxious to hear this morning from my colleagues about what they're doing and what we can learn from them to better the role of civil society in Russia. So thank you, Will.
Thank you, John. And we'll begin then with our first speaker, who is Dmitry Bartenov, who holds a doctorate in international law from St. Petersburg State University. He currently practices as an attorney in St. Petersburg, advising many human rights organizations in Russia and internationally. He is very much engaged in disability law, LGBT issues, nonprofit law, international human rights, and also the European Convention on Human Rights. We're going to begin with Dmitry. So, Dmitry, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning, and let me first thank the Canon Institute for inviting me to speak at this interesting conference. And, of course, I would like to thank the Jackson Foundation for making this event possible. As a human rights lawyer, I have been doing public interest or strategic litigation, as we most commonly describe it in Russian, in Russia for over 10 years now. And as Will said, my practice primarily covers three areas, which are mental disability rights, LGBT rights, and the right of assembly or the non-profit legislation in Russia. And in my today's presentation, I would like to talk about the developments in primarily in two controversial areas, mental disability rights and LGBT rights. And I hope to demonstrate how employing similar mechanisms and relying on sometimes similar strategies did not necessarily allow us to achieve the same results in advancing the rights of these two stigmatized groups. Let me start first with the mental disability field, where I believe public interest litigation, as I hope to show, has brought tremendous changes in law and also has brought in many important opportunities for Russian civil society. I've tried to summarize here on this slide some major characteristics of the Russian mental health system, which were decisive for us, for organizations which I'm working with in the process of selecting the areas for public interest litigation. And without going into much details, I just wanted to highlight the first two interrelated points, which are the monopoly of the state over the provision of mental health care and the extremely closed nature of mental health institutions in Russia. There are virtually no private mental hospitals or social care homes for people with mental disabilities in Russia, and unlike in the States, for instance, mental health sector is dominated by the state power and is actually and it views its role as a guardian of so-called state interests primarily, rather than promoter of mental health well-being of individuals. And therefore, the mental health sector is still very much linked with the law enforcement agencies or forces in Russia. And the culture of isolation is so deeply rooted in mental health care sector in Russia that the mere attempt to open the door or to take a critical look inside the institutions is still regarded as a as an intrusion, as a threat to the stability of the system and of this sacred area. When I took one of my first cases back 10 years ago, I easily realized this because I was then defending a guy who was in his early 20s and he was deprived of his legal capacity by a court decision which he was not even aware of. And when he tried to challenge this decision and to claim back his legal capacity, he was immediately placed in the hospital and punished by the system for his attempt to claim his rights. And not only did he suffer from his attempt to assert his rights, but the system tried to pursue his lawyer, myself, and I had to face disciplinary sanctions from the bar of attorneys for trying to defend the client who lacks legal capacity. Eventually, the St. Petersburg bar took my side and was quite supportive in this case, which was the very first instance in the Russian system where a person with mental disability without legal capacity tried to challenge the deeply rooted culture of isolation, of discrimination. And eventually the bar actually awarded me with the annual recognition award for doing this case, but we spent nearly 2 years arguing with various authorities whether I was doing the right thing and whether the client could choose a lawyer. The key areas for, based on our assessment of the sources of the problems, we've selected the following key areas for strategic litigation in Russia. So we wanted to challenge also the legislative background, the legislative causes for discrimination and segregation of people with mental disabilities. So we tackled the legal capacity framework, which we understood as basically as a civil death of the person. Once a person is judged legally incapable, he cannot claim any rights or even have any kind of standing in protecting his rights himself. Lifelong institutional placement. Russia still, even 10 years after we started the litigation, Russia still primarily relies on the institutionalized model of healthcare, and for many people with mental disabilities, lifelong placement in social care homes where conditions are deplorable and where ill treatment is daily routine, such conditions are the only opportunity to continue their life. Understanding the amount of prejudices against people with mental disabilities within the mental health care system itself, and they understand equally that the same prejudices and the same stereotypes are characteristic to the judiciary. We decided to target the higher courts in order to set case law and in order to put pressure on the to change the, not only the legislation but the practice. So some selected milestone cases which are listed here served two goals, or served a dual goal. Not only have they changed the law or practice in the mental health sector, but they have also sent a strong message to the society at large. For the first time, these judicial decisions affirmed that people with mental disabilities are equal holders of human rights, and they're not only passive receivers of care, and they're not only subjects of the protection of the state, but they also can be equal actors in claiming their rights. So, following the decision of the European Court of Human Rights in 2008, the Russian Constitutional Court issued a number of historic, without any underestimation can be said, historic decisions which tackled the very basics of the Russian respective legislative framework and contributed towards changing the legislation in this area. Most importantly, the Constitutional Court said that people with mental disabilities, even those who have no legal capacity, they cannot still be detained definitely without any judicial review. The judicial review should be based on the same principles as apply to people who have full legal capacity. and no placement in social care home without a court decision is also possible. And in 2013, last year, the Constitutional Court issued a judgment in which the court ended the existence of the plenary guardianship model, which is still the only option used for protecting people with mental disabilities in most former Soviet Union countries. So the judgment was criticized by many civil law professors in the academia, and still is not accepted. And I think it's because it went beyond the legal knowledge in Russia, and the court based its judgment primarily on the international human rights standards, which are not yet perceived or supported by mental health professionals or by legal professionals in Russia. Speaking about implementation of those important decisions, I think we've also had quite successful outcomes, and this demonstrates that the strategy of using high courts as the basis for advancing rights of people with mental disabilities has proven to be effective. After the first decisions of the Constitutional Court, immediately the practice of legal incapacity hearings has changed, and many people were given back their legal capacity. But in the following years, major legislative reforms happened, and some basic principles of healthcare legislation, of civil legislation were changed. And basically, the Legislative Assembly affirmed that people with mental disabilities have the same access to consent treatment, have the same right to refuse hospital treatment as people with full legal capacity. And this year, the Civil Code was amended, and the supported decision-making model instead of plenary guardianship was introduced based on the model which is found in the convention, UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. But apart from pure legal impact and pure legislative changes, I think the strategic impact of mental disability cases have been much broader, because those decisions, they tackled deeply rooted stereotypes against, prejudices against people with mental disabilities. And they have also empowered people with disabilities and many disability NGOs. I believe that it's primarily because of those judgments of the European Court, the Constitutional Court in Russia, many user groups, they started to be vocal, they started to claim their rights publicly, and they had a very firm ground for making their claims. The public debate of the mental health care has been initiated by those decisions, and again, a lot of criticism was directed towards the institutional model of healthcare. And also, it has become a good model for other former Soviet Union countries, which rely primarily on the same model of care. Turning to the strategic litigation in the LGBT field, I should say that unlike in the mental disability field, where grassroots activism is almost non-existent in Russia, and until recently, disability NGOs have been quite passive, gay and lesbian rights activism has been growing and has become visible in recent years. However, issues for strategic litigation in this field have been largely prompted by the authorities' reluctance to tolerate homosexual minority in the public domain, in any public discourse. And indeed, in early 90s, Russia repealed criminal sanctions for homosexual relations. However, once LGBT activists became visible, the state fought back. I put some important LGBT cases on this slide, and I put a question mark after defining them as victories, because although we had successful cases on the international level, for instance, in 2010, the European Court of Human Rights criticized Russian authorities for denying for three consecutive years gay rights activists in Moscow their right to hold peaceful assembly. And in 2012, the UN Human Rights Committee also criticized as discriminatory the Russian law, one of the original laws banning so-called promotion of homosexuality, which has been widely discussed internationally, I believe. But despite these decisions, unlike in the mental disability field, Russian state have been absolutely ignorant and have has demonstrated that they would not follow any of these international standards. And the Constitutional Court issued two decisions which effectively endorsed the legislation which we were fighting against and effectively supported the promotion of homosexuality ban in Russian region, clearly disregarding the international standards. So the cases here, they are illustrative of how using international human rights standards have not only produced the same successful results as in the mental disability field, but on the contrary, Russia has demonstrated a high level of immunity towards any international criticism and simply ignored these human rights standards, which require respect for the freedom of speech of LGBT minority. Nevertheless, I believe that these cases have been empowering for the Russian LGBT community, and despite the fact that our strategic litigation activities have been mostly limited in protecting and saving those rights which were already there before adoption of this no promo homo laws, but still it has demonstrated that this legislation, despite its repressive nature, coupled with the litigation activities, helped many LGBT activists to go in the public sphere and demonstrate that LGBT community will not continue to tolerate such restrictions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dmitry. Our next speaker is going to be Nadia Zhev. Is Anna? Okay, we'll have Anna go next, then. That's okay. Anna Deminova, who holds a doctorate from the Ural State Law Academy, where she focused on the legal consequences of European court decisions on the Russian Federation from 1999 to 2006. Dr. Deminova worked for a prominent public interest law firm in Yekaterinburg, and since then she has served as a consultant to the Ombudsman for Human Rights in the Sverdlovsk Oblast.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and to participate in the event. In my speech, I will focus on the special aspects of the regional ombudsman, regional ombudsman's activity in public interest law sphere. But previously, I would also like to make a small introduction to the process of the formation of public interest law in Russia. And I will refer to my 7 years experience with the human rights NGO Sotajnik. describing the process of formation of the public interest law in Russia, it's important to start with the activity of NGOs in the middle 90s, when the Russian constitution was adopted, and it was really necessary to test how the social and political rights could be bring into real life. I used to work for human rights NGO Sotajnik, which was famous for bringing cases against the authorities and against the state, which was quite unusual those time. But in fact, it was the only way to push the system, to push the state to implement these constitutional obligations and international law obligations, because you know that every social and political rights of the individual requires the correspondent obligations of the state. And that is why actually the NGO challenged the omissions of state to act and challenged every provision of law which restricted human rights and contradicted to the constitution and international law treaties. Here I can suppose a little distinction in the process of formation of public interest law in Russia, which is quite interesting. If the starting point of the formation of the public law, interest law in the U.S. was the disbalance between the individual rights and the corporation rights, but there was no corporation those times in Russia, and we had a disbalance between the individual interests and the strong state. That is why the NGO challenged the strong state. One day we got to know that what we do is called strategic litigation cases, or something like a conception of public interest law cases. When we talk about the obstacles in this process in dealing public interest law cases, we can see the following disappointing features of our judicial system. The first one is that the class actions are not allowed by the Russian legislation. The second one is that the continental law system is not flexible enough to operate with the categories of public interest and balance of interest, public policy or something like this. And judges have very narrow margin of appreciation to refer to public interest policy and all these categories. And the third obstacle is that in practice, there is a certain resistance from the national courts to apply the international human rights standards. That is why the strategy in taking cases through the European Court of Human Rights was something like an NGO's attempt to overcome this obstacle. It was rather this strategy was rather successful. We won a number of cases, but now the strategy of the NGO is to promote application of these international law standards at the national level. And I believe Anton will refer to this experience. And now I will proceed to the role of the regional ombudsman and the strategies which are used to overcome the mentioned obstacles. The first role of the ombudsman is to identify what the public interest is in every single situation. What is the object of the protection, and how it will impact to certain category of people. What another interests are involved? Is there any conflict between these interests and how to deal with them? The main source of information here is a huge amount of written and oral complaints from people to the ombudsman. Also, we initiate monitoring on certain topics. For example, we usually do it on conditions of detention. The second role of the ombudsman is, of course, raising the public awareness on the issue. The third stage is to choose the right strategy, including but not limited to litigation. As to litigation, yes, we do provide for legal support in public law interest cases when they expect a positive impact to the human rights situation, especially in situations with massive human rights violations. For example, we do it in cases protecting disabled people rights to accessible environment. We do it in protecting rights in social benefits and so on. The second strategy is that in some cases we prepare the written opinion of the ombudsman for the court. It is assessed by the court like any other written evidence with no special status, but we hope that courts find it very helpful in human rights expertise by the ombudsman. And we consider these documents like amicus curiae, something like a third-party intervenience to assist the court to obtain the relevant information in the human rights context and interest balance. We use it in migrants cases, freedom of expression cases, right to family life cases, guardianship cases, and so on. We usually make a summary of the European court practice in these documents if relevant. The third strategy is that ombudsmen may also initiate a joint investigation with other state agencies and also with the prosecutor's office. Recently, we had a joint investigation on the complaints, which we got many complaints from women on the violations of their rights for maternity benefits. So we found many violations during this joint investigation. We found we established some reasons and sources of these violations, and then a special report on this topic with analytical information and recommendations to the state bodies was prepared. As to special and annual reports and analytical work of the ombudsman, this annual and special reports contain the information on the facts and the reasons of human rights violations in the region, and also the detailed recommendations to state and local bodies how to improve the practice and the law. Also, the recommendations include the international human rights provisions to apply. The reports are sent to these state bodies and agencies, and they are published in the regional newspapers and websites, and so it's open to public. Another strategy is lobbying the improvements to the regional and federal law on public interest cases and issues. It's also a strategy to handle gaps in legislation. We successfully initiated the improvements to the regional regulations of the health securing programs, issues of employment of disabled people, and also a regional program of pro bono legal aid and others. This was about the strategies which also can be combined. But I would also mention about the important role of the ombudsman in the public interest law cases, as I see it. I think it's the coordination and the cooperation between all the actors who are involved to the public interest cases and development of this process, I mean, such as NGOs, legal clinics, lawyers who make pro bono cases, and also the journalists to cover, to provide for the media coverage of the cases and impacts and social changes. To conclude the brief on the role of the regional ombudsman, I would stress that there are so many challenges in public interest law in Russia nowadays, and there are many things to do, so we just keep moving.
Thank you so much, Anna. Our next speaker will be Nadezhda Kutakova, who is the founder and director of the Planeta Nadezh, Planet of Hope's organization. She focuses on human and ecological rights of people living in the Chelyabinsk region, who have suffered from nuclear pollution for over a half century.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for this invitation. It's so nice for me to take part in this very interesting event. And I'm sorry for my English, because usually I'm living in Russia and have no possibility every day to use my English. I would like to tell you about our experience as an environmental and human rights NGO in Chelyabinsk region. We work and live in a closed city, a nuclear closed city in Azovsk. Chelyabinsk region, you know that it is a Ural, it is a production heart of Russia, and there are many dirty environmental production, especially steel production and nuclear production, still are situated at Chelyabinsk region. We created our NGO, the Planet of Hopes, in 1999. And first of all, we had two main goals of our activity. It is a develop of human rights and the civil society in closed city in Russia, and also to defend environmental rights of people who still are living in contaminated place, first of all, in nuclear contaminated place. And now we have 15 years of experience how to work and live in the contemporary condition of Russian law and Russian situation. And we think that our experience is successful, but I am not sure that we can spread our experience for as a good example for another NGO, because it is a maybe once or unique experience. Because for many years of our job, we had many intimidations from the state. We had many situations when we had a direct threat from the state for many people from our NGO. But we still live and work successfully. I would like to tell you about situation in Chelyabinsk region and about public interest in environmental issues in our region and my vision of this situation. First of all, I would like to tell you that I can share situation and environmental issues and defense of rights of people of my region as a private interest and public participation. First of all, it is a situation with the Techa River. Techa River, it's a river which has begin in the huge nuclear production in Russia. In the period from 1949 until now, we have situation when the nuclear combine is contaminated Techa River by nuclear waste, and still we have four villages there. The second part of our job is defense of right people who suffered from nuclear contamination, who lived or who still are living in contamination areas. Our job is shared for two parts. First of all, it's a part to develop public participation of prevention of potential dangerous activities of chemical industry or nuclear industry, and the second part to defend the private interests of concrete people and for receipt of compensation for damage of health. And I can constate that today there are many public proceedings in Russia in which people can take to defend their right in case of planning of potential dangerous activity through mechanism and through proceeding of public participation. First of all, it is a public hearing. And in this case, many, not so many today, as for example 10 years ago, but some of environmental NGO can organize trainings for people who would like to defend their rights and take part in a public hearing and give their knowledge about law norms, because you know that for people not so easy to understand all complicated system of environmental law. Not in Russia, but it's my notes totally. And the second part of NGO job, as I told before, it is to receive, to give for people possibility and organize their defense and local courts to receive compensation for environmental damage. But I can tell that today we have not so many NGO, environmental NGO in Russia, as we had it, for example, 15 or 10 years ago. And it connects, of course, with two reasons, for my opinion. First reason, it is because the environmental NGO, most of them, lost the international financial support, and not so many foundations are ready to support environmental activity for Russian NGOs today. But from another side, I see that the state understood how huge potential activity people can organize, and began to create a pro-state environmental NGO who usually defends position of corporations or private persons who are interested to develop dangerous environmental activity in the region. We have these things in Ural, and also I see these things in Russia. Another part of our job, as I told before, it's a way to give people possibility to defend their rights in local court to receive compensation for environmental damage. I can tell about our experience for people who suffered from nuclear accidents in the Ural and many years could not receive compensation from the state. Of course, for people it's more easy to understand that they receive money for compensation than to explain them that maybe in future, if there any dirty production will be organized, they will be suffer. It is difficult for Russian mentality to understand the not close consequences for them. For them, more easy to understand that they receive compensation for damage. But in this way, we also have many difficulties. It's alone difficult for us. For example, first of all, today it's extremely difficult, almost impossible, to prove environmental damage from the chemical or nuclear industry, and usually scientists do not support a position either they are independent, they usually don't support idea that this damage from the environmental or from chemical contamination. The second point is impossible to count environmental damage for people today, because no special regulations and no court practice how to count damage, especially moral damage for people who suffered from environmental contamination today. And the third problem which I see today, for after 10 years of our work, the generation of judges, the generation of officials are changed. And for example, if we began 10 years ago to work with the judges, and it was a personal training for them, because each time I come to court and explain the judges which norm we can use from international practice, from something else, and now judges are changed. And the situation is terrible, because I see that each time I must to begin from the zero, and it looks for me now that after 10 years of working, I counseled two heads of Dragon, but today I have a new 15 heads, and I began from the zero each time. And of course, it's very difficult, because the judges and officials are not educated in their fields. But for me, because I continue to work in these fields, I see some options, some specialties, which allow for us to develop our activity, to continue our activity. And the first of all, it's for my opinion, it's a big thing in Russian law, still is permitted, that according to Russian law, any person can defend another person in civil and administrative process. For example, me, I have not law education. My education, I am sociology and politology. But during last 10 years, I successfully defend people and also won one case in European court. So many active people who can receive their knowledge from the books or who can receive their knowledge from our trainings can go to court and defend their neighbors or their relatives who suffered from anti-environmental activity. And the second point is that the people understand that environmental issues is more understandable issues for them than, for example, another rights, as the minority rights or migrant rights or LGBT rights in Russia. And in all situation, it will be important for them to defend their environmental rights. From another hand, I see that sometimes people are ready to refuse from their future environmental rights for today money compensation issue. But sometimes it is a way for us to develop their mentality in this direction. And the third point that now we can act through the different state departments. I'm also advisor of Ombudsman of Chelyabinsk region in environmental and human rights in closed cities directions. So I see that we can give our knowledges, our practice for pro-state NGO in case of cooperation with them. Because I can state that there is a lack of their knowledge, and they need specialists, and why no? We can use the cooperation with them to put our ideas and to put our successful practice in their field. Of course, maybe it's not a direct way, but you know that Russia not always finds a direct way. And my conclusion, as a sociologist, I wrote my conclusion very long way, but I tried to articulate it in English very shortly. I think that the positive rights must to be formulated according to common environmental imperative, because environmental issues still are extremely important for us, for generation, for our future. The second point, we must to develop our activity to organize court proceedings and compensation for people for environmental damage, because for Russian mentality, it is a most understandable way. But at the same moment, we must to have opposition in the issues when the state or private corporation are ready to pay for potential environmental damage, and for this money they try to receive agreement of people to develop potential dirty activity. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much, Nadezhda. And our final speaker is Anton Burkov. He is currently the Galina Starovoitova Fellow here at the Kennan Institute, but he also holds a doctorate degree in law from Cambridge University, as well as degrees from Essex University, Tumen State University, and the Ural State Law Academy. He began his legal career in Yekaterinburg, also with Sutyazhnik, and he has litigated numerous human rights cases before the European Court. And he is, amongst his many awards, a past recipient of the National Endowment for Democracy, Reagan Cassell Democracy Fellowship. Anton.
Thank you. One more second. Here we go. Welcome, everybody. It's the morning, and today I would like to speak in general about public interest law in Russia from the point of view of a Russian strategic litigation NGO, the NGO which does strategic litigation. A few words about this NGO. Anna was already referring to it. It's NGO Sutyazhnik, which means basically a litigator with some which does help people to defend their rights through strategic litigation, which basically a litigation, education, and spreading the news, the message about human rights. And we do it within the national courts and before the European Court of Human Rights. When speaking about public interest law in Russia, we can't avoid looking at the public interest law in development in the U.S., the history of this phenomenon in the U.S., and we can find a lot of similarities. Well, public interest law developed in the U.S. It has a long history. It's already 100 years old. There are now the entire industry, law clinics, pro bono services of law firms, special pro bono non-profits, special public interest law law firms, which manage to make money out of litigating public interest cases, and special foundations which support this kind of activity, and the whole mentality exists. There are hundreds of books, and just started work studying here, researching here. I saw so many books like The Courage of the Convictions. That's the whole history of 16 cases reached the U.S. Supreme Court by Peter Irons. Well, this is like a Bible of strategic litigation by Tushnet, National Association of Advancement of Colored People, Legal Strategy Against Segregation Education. I'm happy to have access to this kind of materials to basically later use this knowledge when litigating cases in Russia. However, public interest law has become a victim of its own success, like the European Court of Human Rights. It was so popular, so the government had to cut it, cut access to do strategic litigation cases. It developed some drawbacks, but we won't discuss this. We will go into the Russian experience of litigating public interest law, and we can see the same kind of drawbacks. Although the history of public interest law cases litigation in Russia is maybe 20 years old. It's very important to notice that almost just 20 years ago, we could not speak about public interest law in Russia, just because there was no access to ports, no access to ports with lawsuits against the government for some wrongdoings or inactions. And with the new constitution of 1993, which has a direct force, it stated that everybody has a right to bring a case against the government. And then a special law followed on bringing lawsuits against the government for some wrongdoings. Unfortunately, since the peak of this access to courts was in the end of the 90s, and I'm speaking mostly about the Supreme Court of Russia, now it's much more difficult to bring a case before the Supreme Court. Since then, starting from the beginning of the 21st century, the last 14 years, the legislature was cutting procedural provisions, which made it harder to find a plaintiff to have a good standing before the court. For example, recently we had a case where a widow was challenging an act of the government which was the cause of the death of her husband. And the Supreme Court said that she has no standing because her rights were not violated. The Supreme Court didn't pay even attention to the special paragraph that we included in the lawsuit, which explains that she is an indirect victim. And, well, apparently the Supreme Court is of the position that her late husband has to bring the case. Another very important drawback is the Article 333 of the Civil Procedure Code. I won't go into very much detail. We call this provision half evil because of the number. So now we brought the case Yenikeyev versus Russia before the European Court of Human Rights because we exhausted all the domestic remedies, which basically did not exist. This person was willing to challenge so-called phenomena, propiska, you might know this, which is in the regulation by the federal government. So he brought the case before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court just ruled that his application was inadmissible. So Yenikeyev wanted to challenge, appeal this decision on admissibility, filed an appeal, but we found out that since 2010 there is a new rule, which is incorporated into Article 333, which says that yes, you can appeal decision on inadmissibility, but nobody will call you to the appeal hearing. Nobody will inform you about the time and the place where the appeal will take place. So that's the wording of this Article 333. But the practice of the Supreme Court went even further. It says, as we found out at the hearing, even if you yourself will find out the place and the time and will come to the court, the judges will not allow you to speak to the court. So you, an applicant, in your own case, and you are not allowed to speak. That's not access to justice. So now, that's the problem of the European Court of Human Rights. And there is a link when you can find all the materials, including the application, which is in English. The second element of the public interest law, a network of law clinics. Yes, it is developed in Russia. There are a lot of law clinics, a coordination center. It's probably very much beneficial for students to work on some, let's say, consumers' rights cases. But unfortunately, those law clinics, they are not involved in public interest law cases. They're very much self-restricted. They try not to be involved in public interest cases. For example, one university in Yekaterinburg, I personally tried to get involved into the case of Yenikeyev versus Russia. But because this case was against the Supreme Court, and particularly against the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the law clinic was not involved. That's why we had no choice but to go and cooperate with a law clinic in North America, in the North American universities and European universities. As any NGO, we have limited resources, so we try to use these kind of resources like law clinics to do major research. Then pro bono law firm services of law firms. Again, it's gradually coming to Russia. It's not still developed as, for example, the law clinic network. But we already can see that it's very much hard to find a law firm which will do pro bono work on public interest case. Will be involved not in litigation, but even in the research, even anonymously. And the reason is that the conflict of interest, sometimes law firms represent the government, or potential conflict of interest, or just they don't want to be involved in public interest litigation against the government if they have an office in Moscow. So again, we had no choice but to work with law firms from international law firms which have no offices in Moscow, in Russia. And still, those firms work on researching, on research on the cases, but anonymously. And I don't know if there is a representative of the International Seniors Lawyers Project, that's the NGO non-profit organization in the US through which we find pro bono services of law firms. And I'm very grateful for this opportunity. It's difficult to find funding for strategic litigation for the reason that the results is far away. The next case I will be speaking about, it's already 11 years old, and we still have no results. In this book, The Legal Strategy of the National Association of Advancement of Colored People, it took them 40 years to get to the judgment of Brown versus Board of Education. Very careful tactic, planning of numerous law cases. Well, they were lucky they found they had this Garland Fund which supported them and found its place in the history. Limited education in public interest law, and particularly this element of the European Convention on Human Rights and the European Court of Human Rights. And I stress this because for Russia, the European Court of Human Rights is sort of quasi-Supreme Court now for Russia, or quasi-Constitutional Court for Russia. European Convention is a legally binding instrument for Russia, for Russian legal system. But it's very rarely taught in law schools. And by its own nature, teaching the way you can file a case before the European Court of Human Rights is it's teaching to litigate cases strategically. So when you go through the national courts, you have to use all the tools available to implement the European Convention before the local judge. To explain to the judge that the European Convention is not a foreign law, it's a national law, it's legally binding, and if Russian law contradicts to the European Convention, please apply European Convention. But despite this negative, maybe features, trends, we do have successes, as you saw from previous presentations. There are successes, and just a few examples. Mikhailov versus Russia. You've heard about a lot of information about the protests in Russia and what's more importantly about arrests of those protested on the streets and detention and cases against them and fines put on them and incarceration, sorry. We tried to look at this situation, and a couple of days ago there is a new initiative. In 2012, the new law was introduced which raised fines for participating in protests and resisting arrest 10 times more. So it's not even, as we call it, administrative charges now. It's more like a criminal charges against the participants. And now, a couple of days ago, there was a new initiative by a deputy of a state Duma, which proposed to advance a new law, a new provision, which will make a criminal offense to participate in a public protest if you previously was arrested and punished. So we tried to look at this case in this situation in 2007, when the first mass arrest took place. Mikhailova was arrested, and she's a pensioner, she's not a lawyer. She went to the court, she was administratively charged for participating in illegal protest and then resisting arrest. She asked for a free lawyer, which was refused, and fined. So when bringing the case before the European Court of Human Rights, we strategically thought we're not going to put any other questions before the European Court but one: whether this person was entitled to a free legal aid in the charges put against her. We call those charges criminal charges because the potential conviction was 15 days in prison. We're still pending this judgment on this case, but hopefully this year it will be delivered. And there's a link over there. You can access all the documents in English. Movement of prisoners for better conditions of prisoners. There are a lot of cases that were already decided by the European Court of Human Rights on prison conditions, healthcare system available for prisoners. But most of the problem comes from the amount of space they have, the floor space for each prisoner. So again, we try to look at this program from a little different angle, why there is so much limited space. And we found out that there is a federal regulation of the federal government which actually established that each prisoner is entitled just for 2 square meters of floor space. So according to this federal government regulation, the new prisons are built from the amount of space per prisoner is calculated from this regulation. And this regulation itself is in contradiction to the European Human Rights Standard developed by the European Court of Human Rights. So right in the beginning, in the law, there's a violation. And we try to challenge this regulation before the court with the help of the widow of a person who died in this small cell. And as you heard, Supreme Court didn't want to hear it because it was filed by a wrong person. Let's see how the European Court decides this case. And one more case. Again, as in strategic litigation has a life in itself. Sometimes you don't know how it will end up. It's the same in the U.S. in this book. Sometimes you wonder how case end up. They plan one thing, but happens another. When we started this litigation in 2003, when a political party, regional political Russian Labor Party, regional office was asked to provide a list of members and all the information, actually the applications, to be a member of the party. This party refused, saying that that's intervention into the inner activity of the non-governmental organization. We didn't know that this case will be so important for today's Russia, for all these checkups of NGOs by prosecutors, by Minister of Justice, which quite often require to provide them with a list of members of NGOs. This case is before the European Court of Human Rights since 2005. We're still waiting for the decision. Hopefully it will come out this year. And again, there is a link where all the materials there. It's one of the strategies that we use. We put all the materials online so we can find other applicants to join our lawsuits or use our materials. In those days of the National Association of Advancement of Colored People, they used advertisements looking for plaintiffs. And again, this case is very much similar to the case I found in this book by Daisy Bates, who refused to provide this list of members and was fined for $200, a repeated fine. She went to the Supreme Court and won on the basis that that's interference with the right of association. So, conclusions. What is the future of public interest law in Russia? The future depends on whether we have access to courts. National courts, Supreme Court, Constitutional Court. Unfortunately, the situation with the Supreme Court is not bright. In 1998, Russians got access to the European Court of Human Rights because we ratified the European Convention. But unfortunately, even the European Court of Human Rights is not as effective as it could have been. Many cases I mentioned today pending before the European Court for 10 years, 7 years. Luckily, those cases are precedential, so they will have an effect, even they would be considered 10 years later. But still, that's the most important prerequisite of the public interest law, to have access to courts. And all those other elements, like access to services of law clinics, pro bono law firms, let them be anonymous. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anton. Thank you, all our speakers. We'll open up to questions in a moment, but I do want to ask the first question, and I guess it's because all of you are, into one degree or another, on the front lines and are the first kind of people who interact with people as they begin to want to assert their rights and want to understand their rights. So I was just curious if you could comment on how citizens who come to appeal to you understand their rights. Do they come with, you know, a general perception that they have certain rights and they want to find a way to defend them? Do you as attorneys have to explain in great detail these rights? How do you interact with the public, and how do the general public perceive their rights as when they come and approach you for legal assistance? I'll let you begin.
Okay.
Take a shot at that.
Yeah, thanks. That's a very good question, and of course, doing strategic litigation successfully requires not only a good lawyer, but it requires a good client, and probably it's the right client.
Ideal.
Yeah, ideal client, which is probably even more important. I've been dealing with the cases in the mental disability field where the clients are by very definition are not the easiest ones, and I think that doing mental disability cases has been the most rewarding experience in my legal career, and I find that what I've learned from this practice is that people with mental disabilities are absolutely the same clients, are absolutely the same in terms of having certain limitations, in terms of having the same level of expectations, the same trust, and so on. At the same time, mental disability cases, sometimes they touch upon the very personal life stories of people. And I found it very supportive that many clients who were intimidated by the system, who were reprimanded by the system for their activism, they eventually understood that what they were doing, that the cases which they were pursuing were not only for their personal benefit, but they were for the benefit of many other clients in the same situations. And they agreed to wait. They agreed to overcome certain harsh times, and that was very supportive. And educating clients, explaining why the case is important. I think that every client, even with a severe disability, with severe intellectual problems, can understand that on the, some basic level that they are doing a very important thing. And I'm honestly grateful to many of our clients who were supportive and had passion enough to go through the entire process.
I would like to add just some points that now there are some people who come to the ombudsman and because they want to solve their own problem. But actually there are many people who want to challenge the situation, not to have just a result for their own case, but they say it orally in the litigation that they want to stop the violation for those category of people. I had a client who was denied his wheelchair disabled person, and he was denied to access to the restaurant because of his status. And we had a very strong case, and he is a very nice fellow. And his speech in the court was that, okay, I was abused by these people from the restaurant. And the purpose of my case is not to get a compensation. It's nothing for me. It's just a, something like a result for media. But I want to stop this violation and I want to prevent it from other wheelchair people. And I want to stop this discrimination against disabled people. So I guess the judge was touched very much with this speech and with this idea to help not only in his own process, but also to help other people. So this is the ideal client.
Yeah. And just a few words. Once we come up with the slogan of our NGO, we will help you to defend your rights. It's not us who will defend your rights. That's you. We just give you the tools. We will help you. And the ideal clients, as Anna said, it's not a person who would do it for some compensation, but often for yourself and for others. I recently met a person who once reported to the police about a violation of a traffic rules, quite a dangerous violation, and he wrote a complaint, and later he realized the police disclosed his private data, telephone number, home address, to the person who actually violated those rules, and this person, of course, called him up and started to threaten. So he said, I want to stop this practice. I want to go to the Constitutional Court and have a ruling. I will go to the European Court. So, and he is quite capable, actually, to do his own applications, and we just are helping them. That's important that we have such people who have a public interest mind.
Open the floor for questions.
Hi. I guess this question is for everybody, but also Anton and Dimitri. So my understanding was that the European Court of Human Rights, in the past and still today, if there are cases that come out in favor of your clients, they hold damages. So the Russian government or whatever local court or institutions, they have to pay penalties, and also they have to reverse a decision or provide compensation or some such aspect. So is that still occurring? And my part two would be, I would think that that was having some kind of repercussion, or there would be some kind of movement by the Russian government to acknowledge deficiencies. But Dmitry, you were saying in cases of LGBT, the government is refusing to acknowledge penalties. I'm not sure if I understood that correctly, or movement. So are these the effectiveness of the damages that the European Court of Human Rights requires, is that lessening?
Thanks for your question. It raises a very important issue of compliance of the Russian state with the decisions of the European Court. And indeed, in most cases, the European Court orders the government to pay damages, which is not the problem. And in all the cases, the government paid damages, even although sometimes the awards are quite high compared to what domestic courts normally award. But that's not not a problem. And reversing the individual decision following the finding of the European Court is also not a big deal. The government would do it and issue a new judgment in compliance with the European Court European Court finding. But the problem is that in many cases the importance of the reversing such a judgment, such a national decision, is no longer so relevant for the applicants, because the very declaration of a violation by the European Court is sufficient. What is much more important is indeed to prevent future violations and to implement the rationale of the decision of the European Court. Like, for instance, in the Alexeyev case, which I mentioned, and which concerned banning of peaceful assemblies of LGBT groups in Moscow, the government paid the compensation and reported to the Council of Europe, the overseeing body of the European Court, that we complied with the judgment, because we do not prevent the applicant to hold peaceful assemblies. But in practice, the applicant had never been able to hold peaceful assemblies. And none of the applicants in Moscow were, none of the activists, LGBT activists in Moscow were ever allowed to hold peaceful assemblies. So, and it demonstrates that the authorities, they do not want to comply. The only way is to put political pressure, and the overseeing body of the Council of Europe, the Committee of Ministers, have been criticizing Russia for failing to comply with the judgments, but here we are. And also quite interesting, just one final comment, that when it comes to the international discussion, Russia never questions in its submissions, for instance, to the Council of Europe, to the UN, never questions the right to hold peaceful assembly by LGBT minority, for instance. But when it, and Russia reports that we respect all the obligations, and all the LGBT minorities have equal right to hold the assemblies and so on and so on. But when it comes to domestic rhetoric, it's absolutely different. And many public officials are quite open in their view that we are not complying with the judgment and we are ignoring it. And it's a political decision.
Well, there are some positive signs about following implementing judgments of the European Court of Human Rights in general, like special regulations by the plenum of the Supreme Court of Russia, but we don't have time to praise the system. Let's just say some words about what's wrong with the system. I will use just one example. There are so many judgments of the European Court about the use of Nadzor system. And it's the system where the judgment will be quashed many years later, after it entered into force. And Council of Europe was insisting and advising Russia to change a cassational system into appeal system, where the case will be reconsidered anew. So what happened, what we got in the result? In 2010, We've got a new appeal. But when you come to the court, when you go to the appeal, you realize that, okay, it's called appeal, but I remember it used to be cassation. It's the same. It's the same conveyor. There's no time to really reconsider the case. And when you look at the new type of cassation, you realize that that's used to be nadzor. So I think the governments kind of get used to those, learn how to react to the judgments of the European Court, but to leave it as it used to be before, it used to be comfortable for the governments.
My name's Thomas Grindley. My impression is that Russian public interest law is related to uniquely Russian cultural values. These values, as portrayed by writers such as Gogol and Dostoevsky, tend to be very accepting, maybe too accepting, of government. What has changed since the time of Gogol and Dostoevsky? Are Russians more active now in not so willingly putting up with government and standing up for their rights? Do NGOs truly reflect these changes?
Well, thank you very much for this referral to Dostoevsky, especially because it was a real problem of minds of Russian people to be a victim when we began to fight with this strong state, because it took time to change the minds of the victim. And actually, in 20 years, it has changed by best practices, by disseminating the successful cases and demonstrating that it is possible to protect rights. So that is why maybe Russian people, especially young Russian people, they do believe that it is possible not to be a victim if you refer to this problem. And people do believe that it is possible, and they are active, and they want more resources from NGOs to work on public interest cases. I think so.
Just a short remark. I think since for the last 20 years, we still didn't adjust that we've got courts. I think Russians were quite active all the time. Even in the old time, they used to write letters to Tsar. There's a problem this and there, hoping to get help. And we still write letters to the president. It's surprising that a person facing a big human rights violation, serious human rights violation, and the first idea comes to your mind is to write a letter to the president. But it's useless. Write to court. Find a lawyer. That's what we need to change.
We're going to go with Judge Williams and then back there. Judge Williams.
Really, all the presentations made me think of, or I think it's one of the things that accounted for the success of the interest here, and that is the process by which judges worked, not only following the precedents, but the more important building. You and your work try to nudge towards toward that process, and whether you have any success.
Let me try to answer this question. Thank you very much, Judge Williams. It's a very in my personal opinion as a human rights lawyer, it's you're having sometimes very frustrating moments when you argue very complicated issues and you try to make the judiciary to analyze certain human rights issues or analyze certain concepts, and you do not get any kind of judicial scrutiny of those issues which you aim to criticize. I think it's partially it's the Russian culture of legal practice is to blame for, because judges are not expected to comment on the laws in their decisions, which is very unfortunate, but that's life. They are expected mostly to reproduce the existing norms, and you sometimes cannot really understand how a judge reached certain conclusion based on the norms without any kind of interpretation. Because of the overall lack of independence of the judicial system, I think judges are quite reluctant and afraid of being too active and being too progressive in their decisions. Surprisingly, I've had much more rewarding experience in smaller cities when you have a case unrelated to some political issues, but maybe touching on very stigmatized or groups of people with mental disabilities, where local judges were quite brave to interpret the existing legal norms based on the human rights values and based on the human rights principles, rather than referring to hard law in the which is in the codes or in the legislation. So I think that it will take quite a while for Russian judicial system to be more creative in their legal reasoning.
I also would like to tell about my experience of working with the judges. Usually, the opposite side, opposite party in our cases, environmental and compensation cases, is a state or state department. And usually, a state department wrote a special paper, of our position, which we wrote in application, and usually it's position against our person. And if I see it is a systematical problem, I'm going to official and try to discuss with them. And the big success for me when the State Department writes in their paper for the my excellent success is the State Department writes that for opinion for judge, for discretion of judge. In only in this case, judge began to look real circumstances of these environmental cases. So we should work with the State Departments in these issues, in environmental issues and public law cases.
In the back.
My name is Slava Revin, speaking Human Rights Alliance, and my question, I think, for Anna and maybe for Dmitry, and just now when situation was changed after Crimea annexion, and how do you think is it possible advocacy of LGBT rights with regional ombudsmans? I mean, I'm about pro-Putin hysteria now and a new new intention about change constitution for like marriages like only between men and women and other and other.
Thank you for the question. I would say that
Pro-Putin's history had nothing to do with the obligations of the regional ombudsman to protect people. So it doesn't matter any political issues because they change every day. So that is why no reasons to not to protect these people, and we would do it, but there was no applications on it in Sverdlovsk region for the Sverdlovsk region ombudsman. So, Dmitry.
Yeah, if I could add to this question, of course. LGBT activists and LGBT organizations in Russia are overcoming hard times because with the overall climate not favorable to any civil activism, and the LGBT rights are the easiest target, and they are the easiest, it's the easiest way actually to demonstrate how Western, so-called Western values are imposed on Russia and how they are contrary to the traditional values of Russia, which have been used by the state to justify restriction or total denial and even recriminalization of homosexual rights in Russia. But at the same time, I think in Russia a lot depends on the regional context, and I think that in although ombudspersons they are state officials, they are appointed by the by regional parliaments, and the federal ombudsman is appointed by the state Duma. But I think that sometimes they manage to save certain degree of independence and to be quite vocal about such critical issues, LGBT rights. In St. Petersburg, for instance, my city has been ill-famous for pioneering this process of adopting laws prohibiting propaganda of homosexuality. But the St. Petersburg ombudsman has been quite supportive of local LGBT organizations and has been quite critical of the government's actions in this regard, sometimes being physically present in during meetings, during film festivals where LGBT activists were attacked by protesters and the state failed to do something. And I think it had quite a good effect. So it's a lot depends on personal commitment of the person. I think it's very important.
Okay, I see a lot of hands all of a sudden, so I'm going to take a bunch of questions together. So David, we'll take four together. David, Brandy, Kathy, and Kelly. Then we'll get to Liz.
David Fishman. Anton, this is probably a question for you on the subject of strategic litigation. I think you're absolutely right that the civil rights movement in the U.S. is sort of a gold standard for this kind of thing, and there are other interest groups in the U.S. that have had more or less success in this sort of thing. For example, just yesterday, the Supreme Court came out with a decision on campaign financing, which reflects a strategic approach to these kinds of issues. I wonder if you've run into a particular problem you may have in the European Court of Human Rights, which is that you can perhaps control your own client, you can control your Russian client, but can you not also be influenced adversely by a bad case coming out of, let's say, Turkey or Romania or some other jurisdiction, which also has the right to go to the European Court of Human Rights and come out with either a factual question or a legally presented issue that you'd rather not have had come up, but nonetheless you've got to live with?
We'll go to Kathy, Randy, and then Kelly. We'll take a bunch here.
Thanks. A quick question. Have any of you dealt with cases relating to the rights of religious believers or communities? And thank you so much for your very brave and valuable work.
Andy?
The word brave is a nice lead into my question. You Anton made mention of the books you were reading about the history of public interest law in the United States, and we do have a strong history of brave and courageous lawyers who, not just ideal clients, but I don't know, ideal lawyers, but very good lawyers who fought hard and fought against difficult circumstances in their own lives based on their activities. And I wonder how much resistance, how much maybe even threats you get as lawyers in your brave and courageous work, both from the state and regional authorities and the population, local populations in the areas where you bring cases.
That's a great question. My question is a little bit more mundane, so you can put me at the bottom of the list. I'm interested in the ombudsman and how people perceive it. Do you think that the population perceives it as more a piece of the state, something in between the state and the courts, or something closer to the citizen? And I'm wondering particularly if people tend to bring their complaint in some kind of priority. Do they go to the ombudsman after they've been to court, before they go to court, at the same time?
And we'll take this question. I don't know if it's going to be a
Thanks, everyone, for your presentations. I was traveling in Russia last month, and I was really interested by these signs. I saw these billboards that said, Дети должны учиться вместе, children should all spend together. And it had a picture of different types of children with different disabilities. And so this question might be for Dmitry or for everyone, but I was just curious what these, I was very, you know, kind of surprised by it and curious what the story is behind it, if it's a grassroots movement or if there's been court cases connected to it. Thank you.
Okay, so we have five questions. So I'll kind of assign them, I guess, myself as we go forward here, maybe. But Dmitry or Anton, do you want to comment on adverse decisions in the European Court? Are there any examples where you're pursuing litigation and suddenly a decision from Turkey or another human rights case impacts your decision or your work? Or is that something that is just part of the general flow of European court decisions?
Well, I don't know whether Dima had this experience, but in our work, we had not such, didn't have such experience, but of course we try to find examples in other jurisdictions and in cases against other countries. For example, right now we're building this strategic litigation. We try to convince MAID judges to look at the European Convention, not to ignore our arguments, which are based on the European Convention. We try to build a case where we ask the European Court to rule on violation of Article 6, which is the right to a fair trial, if a local judge ignored our arguments based on the European Convention. And we try to find previous examples, of course, from in other jurisdictions.
Yeah, I would shortly add to this that the European Convention, the case law of the European Court is sometimes it's country specific, but it also it's it's time specific, and the European Convention is an evolving or developing instrument, and many of the decisions of the European Court which have become like standards for review and which have been applied by the European Court, they are outdated in modern circumstances. It does not necessarily mean that it's because it came from Turkey or from another jurisdiction, but it's because it came like 30 years ago when an approach to many issues where it was different. For instance, in an emblematic case is using physical restraints in mental health sector. And like, back in the end of 70s, the European Court said that it's an ultimate discretion of medical practitioners what kind of restraints they use as long as it's justified by the medical necessity. And that's what's what would not be acceptable in the 2014, where the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities sets quite a stronger limitation, and the European Court in its recent decisions has actually referred to the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So we tried, of course, to educate the court, and we tried to achieve a better standard, more level of protection, as I guess happening in every strategic litigation process in the U.S.
Anyone have any experience dealing with religious cases? Or?
No, but I can refer you to a person, Aydar Sultanov. You've probably heard of his name. He is very much pishushi. He writes a lot. He just published, within the last 2 years, he published 3 books, and one each is on European standards in this kind of issues. We can speak later.
I had actually several cases because part of my work is offering legal support to non-governmental organizations, and they are sometimes religious groups. And there is, just a short remark, there is a general trend in Russia that all religious groups which are not part of the mainstream confessions, like of course Russian Orthodox Church and other major confessions, they are not welcomed, I would say, and they are prosecuted occasionally on many pretexts, sometimes on purely formalistic grounds, but they are, but behind those pretexts are actually suspicion or sometimes unwillingness of local authorities to tolerate any kind of alternative confessions. And we, especially when it comes to the Orthodox denomination, in Russia there is Russian Orthodox Church, but there are other Orthodox groups, and they are routinely suppressed also at request by the Russian Orthodox Church, which I find very alarming, but that's the scenario.
I'm going to save Randy's questions for last, because it's a wonderful concluding question. So we're going to move then to the ombudsman question.
Thank you very much for this question, because you know that the success of the activity of the ombudsman depends very much on perception of the population of the region or of the country, if we speak about the federal ombudsman. So I need to say that our ombudsman is very popular among the population, consider the ombudsman like a person who is human rights defender, and because they believe that she can press the regional power to get the result. They do believe that she's something like maybe a person who can do it and to press and to push powers have a result. That is why sometimes something like a fairy tale that you know that she gets so much power, but this is something like a challenge for the ombudsman to be this person they expect her to be. So, but I think it's a positive perception of the people. But it's a very severe obligation for the ombudsman to implement all this expectation. So it's a trick, actually.
I also would like to tell that our ombudsman is very popular in Chelyabinsk region. He is only 33, and he is from NGO, Human Rights NGO. And according regional law, he can take applications only after exhausting all ways of defense, but we prefer unofficially prevention job. We have a public department of ombudsman in each local areas, and local activists or representatives of local NGO have a public consultation, and people come and people write applications, and in most cases the ombudsman is a mediator of prevention job of potential violation. I think for this reason he's popular, and we have many success cases which prevent future violations.
I remember the second part of the question about the courts, if the people come to the ombudsman before courts or after the courts. It's a real problem when they come after the exhaustion of court remedies, because we can do nothing with it. Just to say yes, it's a problem. Sometimes in 1% of the cases we can have a strategic case to the European court if we see that the case will impact to the situation, if we see that there is a massive violation of rights, but it's only 1% of these cases. That is why it's very important that the original law says that this is a pretrial means of public protection on human rights, and that is why it's very important that people come to the ombudsman before they go to court and spoil everything.
Okay. Anyone want to comment on Liz's question about the billboards?
I can visit this as I work with mental disability groups in Russia. Indeed, gradual demand and the process for inclusion of children with disabilities, even children with severe mental disabilities in the mainstream education, it's an achievement primarily of the civil society. And I think that's one of the areas where the state, at least on the level of official authority, has been quite supportive to these ideas, partially because it's not a politicized issue and because it's about children. But in reality, there are certain examples of inclusive education or moving from entirely secluded, segregated education. But in most cases, orphanages for people or children with disabilities are still in existence, and most children, like over 90% of children who are there, they are not orphans in a strict sense. They were abandoned by the parents because the state pressed for this, and that's a real problem.
Okay. And now we will turn to Randy's question, and that is the question about life as a public interest lawyer and the risks that one has, and threats from state and society. How difficult is it to be engaged in these types of public interest activities as an attorney? What sort of experiences have you had in that?
I can start. You're right to mention there are so many courageous lawyers in the U.S. and when I came here last month, I was happy to meet a person I've been willing to meet for the last 10 years. It's John Schlickman. If you know his name, he's mostly known by the name of his famous actor, John Travolta, from A Civil Action. And he came to my presentation at Harvard Law School. It's amazing that how strong he was to actually continue this case. And yesterday I watched this film once again. There are such examples in Russia, maybe not that extreme, but sometimes even worse. Speaking about the NGO, our NGO, which is mostly composed of, used to be composed of young lawyers from who are still sort of law clinic students or just graduates or LLM students. They sometimes have difficulties in finishing the law degrees or passing an exam because so often they will argue the case before against, let's say, election commission, and then they come to the exam and a member of the election commission is on the board of the examinators. My personal experience, William mentioned many degrees from Essex and Cambridge. They're not because of, good life. At some point, I could not defend my PhD dissertation in Yekaterinburg. That's why I was sort of forced to find a way to do my research somewhere else.
My experience is not good, maybe, because for 15 years of our activity, we had many different types of intimidation from the state. First of all, it was a bad reputation for media as a spy, as a foreign agent, or something else who is enemy. But it was not a success company, because if I make a legal consultation which is prepaid for people, it is difficult for people to understand how I can be spy if they told me their complaints. And also we had a taxes cases when we were it was in 2009. It was the first case which Agora NGO won for us. They announced that we did not pay taxes for charitable money, and it was during 1.5 year, and during this time it was every day prosecutor's offices near my door and visitors of FSB agent to kindergarten. It was difficult, but after this, when we won this case, they did not touch us. But last year we changed our strategy. And either during first years of our activity, usually we wrote applications or some announcement from our NGO. Now we wrote it from our clients. Because now I am behind people, not before. Because I can say, it is my client, he wants. What can I do with him? Nothing.
And just one short remark. The prosecution of NGOs but connected with the foreign agent law. But I must say that the prosecution of NGO never actually stopped. When I joined NGO in 1998, the first case I was working on was a prosecution of our NGO based on the 1996 law, which required all the NGOs to undergo re-registration. And it took us 7 years to undergo this process. And now we have three cases pending before the European Court. One already decided, two more cases are pending. So there are constant difficulties for NGOs created.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, so I'm going to bring today's proceedings to a close. I just want to kind of echo what Randy and some other people have said, just the courage that it takes to be a public interest lawyer. I got my start kind of looking at 19th century Russian law, and I'm again reminded of the famous quote of Svestovich, who called the advocates Knights of the Living Word. And I think we've seen examples here today of just how much courage and ability that Russian lawyers must possess and show when they pursue these types of cases. But I want to thank all our speakers and the Jackson Foundation. I'm going to turn it over to John for the last word.
Thank you, Will. First of all, masterful job, Will, by you, particularly with the last five questions, and how you picked the best questions to have an ending. Anton and I had the same reaction about this audience. And before I thank the speakers, I want to thank the audience. Terrific engagement, terrific questions. I had a whole bunch of questions, and you asked them. And so I got the answers. That was wonderful. Nadia and Dimitri and Anna and Anton, not only are you courageous, but you are successful. You know, if it took us 100 years to get to where we are, and we're still at it, of course, in the public interest law sector here, I mean, you've made remarkable strides in the 20 years since the new Constitution gave you access to the courts. And you're young. So if it took the NCAA 40 years, you've had 20. You're halfway there. I think you are going to get there. And your persistence and your bright activism will get you there. And we're just so pleased that Russia signed on to the European Convention and that you do have the European Court for Human Rights. We've learned a lot about that in the last couple of years here at Canon and at the Jackson Foundation. And it is wonderful to hear that while it's got limitations, it is working for you. So thank you for your work. Thank you for your courage. Thank you for your bright activism.
Thanks so much, and thank you for coming.